His writing has been compared to David Sedaris and Roxane Gay. Michael Arsenault has just published his memoir about growing up black, gay and Catholic in Texas. It's entitled I Can't Date Jesus, Love, Sex, Family, Race and Other Reasons I've Put My Faith in Beyoncé. Michael Arsenault, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Growing up black, gay and Catholic in Texas, Michael, which of those three would you say was the greatest challenge?
The Catholic part. only because, you know, I really understand truly and deeply how important faith is, how necessary religion can be for many people, and how useful just altogether can be. However, I think if you are different, and by different in this instance I mean queer, or but in other cases, you know, you are pro-choice, you are anything that deviates from traditional Catholic doctrine can be very challenging for you. And you know, there are a lot of lay Catholics, there are a lot of people who kind of pick and choose, not specifically pick and choose, but like aren't as strict. But I think in my case, I was raised by a devout Catholic. It was very clear what it meant to be gay, between that and other things. And so that's why I had this paranoia and guilt and shame associated with my identity. And as I write in the book, I kind of explain how I had worked really hard to unlearn those things and kind of find my own sense of peace.
And your mom and the and your family and your dad, etc., are coming to terms with the idea of you being gay. Have they managed to come to terms with it in the context of their own Catholic religion then?
It's honestly mostly my mom that had the biggest issue. I think in terms of who, that is still a challenge for, it would be my mother, not really so much the rest. But yes, she's still where she is, and I am still where I am.
Huh. So this book, well, let's talk about the title for a second. I Can't Date Jesus. Where does the title come from?
That actually stems from a conversation that I have with my mom that I write in the book. It's this idea, and I say this respectfully. Again, I really do understand how important religion is. I think there are plenty of brilliant people who are religious. I also think sometimes religion can suspend brilliant people's better senses. And I mean, you know, there are, as Catholic doctrine kind of dictates, a lot of Christian sects, a lot of people understand that you're born gay, but they think that it's an affliction, like kind of like you're some kind of, I don't know, a regular gene sold at a clearance mall or whatever, as far as like your equivalent humanity. And there's this idea that, yeah, you know, you are who you are, but you can't help it, because if you act on it, you would be an affront to God. So it's this idea that you essentially can't be whole. You can't have pleasure. You can't have a partner. You can't have a family. You can't kind of just be what everyone else gets to be without kind of those concerns. And so during the conversation, some comments were made, and just in my mind, I was just like, well, I can't date Jesus. What do you want me to do? And that birthed the book title.
So if she has had such difficulty with it, has she read the book now?
My mom has not read the book, no.
Will she read it?
I don't believe so. But I think if she ever reaches a point where she's kind of ready, I think, you know, maybe the book will help. But at this point, no, she hasn't read it, and she has any intention to read it yet.
You write in the book about your uncle who was also gay and who died of AIDS, and the two explanations, I guess, that you got at the time. So you were only you were six, I think, at the time. And your mum said to you it was because he had used heroin. Your dad said it was because he was gay. Why did they give you different answers?
Well, I think, honestly, you know, kind of mentioned in the chapter, I think it could have been either one. It's just there was one reason why one had the emphasis on the other. And just being six, I didn't necessarily understand kind of like the details. I kind of write later in the book. I have some context as far as my dad goes, and I do understand what my mom probably was just trying to be protective, because I mean, it's probably difficult at the time to explain like the AIDS crisis to a six-year-old in 1990, plus all of these other things. So I mean, they both had different reasons for why they said it, but it could have been either one. So it just was about the emphasis and why one chose one over the other. But at the time, it didn't matter, because all I heard was, you die. So that's where I was.
And how did that impact on you then? I mean, I guess you were a young kid at the time, but as you got older and came to terms with your own sexuality, etc., to know that your uncle had died of AIDS, did that impact on your own way of expressing yourself sexually?
Yeah, so, you know, I kind of mentioned, there's a scene in the book where I mentioned kind of like my earliest signs of not necessarily having the language. But I knew I liked boys more than girls, and it happened around the same time my uncle's passing. So I think, you know, if that's your introduction to something, particularly at that age, you, well, at least not necessarily everyone, but for me, I carried a lot of trauma with that, and I kind of made the association that, you know, to be gay can mean to die. And, you know, there's still very much an HIV crisis within Black and Latinx communities in the United States. It's very much a reality that the rates are really high and not enough is being done to prevent that. That being said, I still had a very unrealistic, not necessarily unrealistic, what I mean is I had a paranoid view. And to some extent, it is unrealistic now because you can be diagnosed with the virus and you can lead a full, healthy life. I mentioned kind of at the point now that the reality is as being Black, my dating pool is much smaller. And the reality is I'm probably going to meet more men who are positive than who are not. And so therefore, I really need to confront that issue. And I did. And I kind of outlined within the book, it's kind of just life is really funny because you have this fear, and then you meet someone, or you just wake up one day, at least in my case, and it's like you're being a ridiculous person, and you work really hard to snap out of it.
And you talk about it being such an issue among African Americans in the US, much more so than amongst the white community?
Statistics will show, like, white people typically just have better access to things in this country and others. And there have been reports before in the past that when you are the least among us, not necessarily in terms of real value, but how you are treated systemically, we have lesser access to proper health care. You know, particularly with the respect to Black and brown queer communities, there have been reports in the past to show that we don't have sex at higher risk rates than any other group. And in fact, if anything, within the Black community, you find that they actually kind of are more tend to be protective. However, when you talk about in terms of preventative care, about the way organizations reach out to, you know, it's interesting, like 20 some years ago, the AIDS crisis was considered basically over for like white gay men. Mm. Meanwhile, everyone else is still kind of grappling with it. And it's because, you know, the closer you are to whiteness, particularly white patriarchy for a white man, you're going to be catered more to than you would someone like me. And that's still an issue. It's interesting that some of these organizations still say that they struggle how to reach Black and brown communities, but I also think, you know, when haven't they struggled to reach these communities? Because it's just the same lack of effort and interest in really kind of like elevating everybody. It's a longer issue, but in terms of how it affects the HIV/AIDS crisis, that's kind of what the underlying problem is.
And obviously things like healthcare and insurance and all of that in the US is such a huge issue as well. Yeah, just being able to afford healthcare in the US is such a huge challenge.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and I understand because I was reading an article that you wrote in the New York Times, the Student Loan Serenity Prayer, which is talking about the student loan situation. So speaking of healthcare, there's also the situation in the US. If you go to college in one of those private colleges, you can end up in considerable debt for a long period of time. Am I right in saying that this is going to be one of the titles of your next book, I Don't Want to Die Poor?
Yes, that is the next book that I'm working on. I want to kind of write this this broader, I want to expand on that essay and kind of write more and more about the overall issues related to all of that debt, because I think particularly in terms of millennial narratives in this country, you can hear all the time that, oh yeah, they buy avocado toast, so that's why they can't buy a house, or oh, they do this, they let chain restaurants die, blah blah blah, but nothing is being said about how essentially the previous generation before us, or particularly the baby boom generation, basically set up future generations to fail. You're told in America, if you go to college, if you work hard, no matter what background you come from, you can attain social mobility. The reality is the system now is not really set up to reward that. There's gross wage stagnation. The job market, no matter what the statistics show, it's not particularly that strong because people are underpaid or they're only working part-time. And then you have the way the debt is set up and where these private companies have been allowed to, you know, I have to take, as I write in a piece, ownership about, essentially I made the choice, but it was very much an uninformed decision. And it was because I was preyed upon because these corporations have been allowed to be preyed upon. Like at this point right now, if I died right now, my co-signer is still on the hook for the rest of my debt.
How much of a loan did you have to take out in total when you look back over those college years?
Well, it was kind of added over the year, but it was very high, tens of thousands, teetering towards something else. So it's a lot of debt. And the reason why it's just set up on a shorter plan, like typically with government issued loans, you have 20, 30 years. People take kind of the time they work with you. I'm on literally a 12-year plan. They're literally just, they want their money or else. Yeah. There's kind of no real alternative. And that's awful to people who, you know, really do want to pay back what they owe, but just are not really given the opportunity to make as much. And
And just to go back to the title of this book, the last part of the title and other reasons I've put my faith in Beyonce. Beyonce was born in Houston in Texas.
Yes,
she was raised there.
I'm back actually home in Houston. I have a book event on Monday. But yes, Beyonce is from Houston.
And was that significant? Is that significant for you?
Very significant because I think, well, you know, there are many reasons why I love Beyonce and I outline them in the book. But one thing I have been saying a lot more lately is that with Beyonce is that she is the biggest pop star in the world and she didn't have to really change who she was to appeal to the masses. I think often, particularly if you are Black or any kind of other in this country, that you are told in order to appeal to the masses, you have to kind of basically scale back and kind of play into what the mainstream or like the white, just the white majority wants from you because you don't want to alienate people. But, you know, for the most part, Beyonce has been very much country Black from Houston. That's been so obvious in her music, her dancing, performances, like so much of her influence. Like she didn't, particularly in R&B, was on decline a couple years ago when everyone, no disrespect to EDM fans, but picked up a glow stick. And R&B was very weird. She didn't do that. She stuck to who she was. And for me, it was difficult to sell the book because there were some people who felt that being Black and gay and wanting to write the book the way I wanted to write it would make me too niche. And niche is a cute little phrase that people tend to tell non-white people means like, oh, you're too much of whatever, and therefore we think you have no appeal. But I've been vindicated in that the book has done really well so far. All types of people are gravitating towards it. I'm talking to you, so I feel not on the same level, not as fun, but like Beyonce, I'm being very much a country Black person from Houston, and I'm just being good at my work and my art, and people are finding it. And I don't necessarily have to dilute who I am to get folks to give me a shot.
Has she received a copy?
No, but we're working on that. I'm actively working on that. She has to read it. Or at least her part, she has to read it.
Sure. Fantastic. Well, it's entitled, I Can't Date Jesus, Love, Sex, Family, Race, and Other Reasons I've Put My Faith in Beyonce. Michael Arsenault, thanks so much for joining us here on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time. Thank you.